with Sam Cedar, where every day is Casual Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday. Tuesday, Casual Tuesday. Wednesday, Casual Hump Day. Thursday, Casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, September 30th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan, on how legislation gets passed in 2022. Then Francesca Fiorentini will join us from the Bituation Room. Also on the program today, Hurricane Ian leaves 23 dead at least, millions without power in Florida. Putin proclaims part of eastern Ukraine now as annexed. The U.S. announces new sanctions. Biden administration shrinks student loan debt eligibility in a bid to leave a Republican lawsuit without standing. Continuing a resolution bill has passed, along with Ukraine funding. And the House tables a stock trading ban because of Nancy Pelosi's poison pill. Housing market takes a major hit as part of the Fed's plan to discipline labor. Trump judge Cannon hamstrings her own independent reviewer. Lastly, the Pentagon setting up a new command to arm and aid Ukraine. All this on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thanks for joining us here as part of the Casual Friday lineup. Of course, I have my soft collared shirt, Emma Vigeland. Emma?
Hello. Hello, Sam.
Soft collar.
Soft
as well.
Sweater. Yeah. Right? Something like that.
Casual Friday. Just one more. September already over.
Jeez.
Yep. Goes quick. Goes really quick. Let's get right into this. I pre-taped the David Dayan interview this morning. I'm not going to talk about why he couldn't. It's not a big mystery. Maybe he mentioned on Twitter, but then it just occurs to me I probably shouldn't say anything about it. So that as it may.
All right.
It doesn't matter.
It's Monday.
Okay.
Is it Monday?
Monday.
No, it's Friday.
Monday. Right. It's completely Monday. Right. Exactly. Let's get into this. The images coming out of Florida, just extraordinary. And I've seen reports that scientists are estimating the amount of rainfall and the strength of this hurricane 10% greater because of climate change. Very difficult, I imagine, to really know this precisely, but certainly we know that the intensity of these storms are increasing because of climate change. The frequency of these storms are increasing because of climate change. You're taxing a system that is already taxed because of climate change in terms of durability. There is going to be billions of dollars worth of damage here. We will talk about this a little bit more in the program, but of course, DeSantis voted famously against such aid when he was a House representative, is now, of course, looking for it from government. But it is a reminder that only government, and really in this instance, only the federal government can address physical event. I mean, I don't know how you want to call it, disasters of this caliber. And really, the disaster comes, I have been told by experts on these type of things, some listeners, that these are not natural disasters. The disaster is a function of human response to these weather events. These weather events are going to increase with frequency and in strength. And the only way that we can deal with them, it's really two-part. One is we need to cut down on those on climate change gases. And then on the back end, we need to have a government that functions well and addresses these issues and prepares well for them. And right now, we barely have either, frankly. And it's not in any way helped by, you know, folks like DeSantis when they're in Congress voting against relief in these situations, because that's what government's for.
Republicans do this all the time. I mean, famously, didn't Rand Paul vote against relief for other areas? And then Kentucky was hit badly. And so then he wants it for himself. That this is why they cannot be trusted to govern, because they will undercut everybody else. But when it's time for help for their own state, you know, they want government to help them out.
Of course. Here is footage from YouTuber Max Olson, who has taken a video in Fort Myers Beach, Florida, and did a time lapse. This is pretty crazy.
Stunning. Yeah.
Jeez. That is,
the swell of those waves is insane, or I guess not even waves, but and all those electrical wires and everything near that water.
And do we know how high that water was at its highest peak?
15 feet, right?
Yeah, from his video, it said the storm surge was 15 feet.
Wow. That's crazy.
And so much of Florida is so low in terms of, like, its sea level. So it just makes them even more vulnerable in terms of just, like, of course, geographically, they're more vulnerable, and also in the land level, relative to the water, they are just so vulnerable to these increasingly intense storms, and it's just going to keep getting worse.
And that's nothing to say about Miami, which is essentially built on a sponge, and there is the water in an event like that. If anything was ever to happen near Miami, the water comes not just from the ocean, but literally from the ground up. I mean,
it's going to have to be Venice.
Yep. All right. We've got a couple of sponsors today, of course. I mean, I only will promote products that I use on this program, as you know, or I guess there's a couple instances where we have products that I don't use, but I've checked out and I think are good products. But this one I use literally, well, actually both of them, I guess, on a daily basis. Of course, I'm talking about sunsetlakecbd.com. Left is best gets you 20% off of all of their products. It gets you 20% off of their flower, their keef, their pre-rolls. That gets you 20% off of their tinctures. They've got 6,000 milligrams. They have 3,000 milligrams, 750, 1,500, three different flavors, the natural, the citrus, and the mint. It gets you 20% off of their coffee with Sebade. It gets you 20% off of their fudge with Sebade and their new line of gummies. They have Sebade gummies, and they have Sebade gummies with a little THC in them as well. Just enough so that it is legal to ship. Great for sleeping, great for relaxing. The pre-rolls, sort of like when I, you know, particularly on the weekends and I have a nice dinner, that's a nice way to cap it. Just all sorts of great products for you to try out. And these are Movement Partners. It's a great company, $20 minimum wage now. They are mostly employee owned. They have contributed tens of thousands of dollars just over the past year to things like refugee relief and give directly and to food pantries and to union strike funds. The list goes on. They are also incredibly good in terms of their farming practices. They practice integrative pest management instead of using pesticides. They use regenerative farming practices. All around, great company. And fans of the show, of course, they're giving you 20% off with the coupon code. They chose it. Left is best. That's at sunsetlakesabade.com. Check them out. Also, every morning when I get up and when and before I go to bed, and then occasionally I'll even do it three times a day, I am using my Quip toothbrush. But in between that, I'm also using a full line of their Quip products that are great for dental hygiene. Quip gets your smile ready. It makes good habits easy with all the essentials you need to care for your mouth. Okay. And they want me to talk about the toothbrush, and I will. But I have to tell you that every time I use, at least once a day, when I use the refillable flosser, I am just blown away by the technology. I guess it's technology. It's just that they design products that are wonderfully designed, that are made to help you, have better dental hygiene, but also to form the habits which make dental hygiene. It does not matter what kind of toothbrush you have if you don't use it on a regular basis. It does not matter what floss you're using if you don't use it on a regular basis. They make it easy. Easy for adults and for children. The Quip electric toothbrush uses time vibrations with 30-second pulses to basically guide you around the four quadrants of your mouth so that you get a recommended 2-minute clean. But you know what? If you want to do a 4-minute, you can do that too. You can even upgrade to the new smart motor to track and improve your brushing and earn sweet rewards. Gamifying stuff for kids, folks. Build your whole routine with even more Quip, like the reusable floss pick, which again, I've told you is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I went home to Worcester with Saul and Milo, both kids, for the holidays. And I found a drawing that I had tried to invent a toothbrush that had like capsules that you would insert that would have like some type of like toothpaste come through it. My parents would never give me a patent for that. I also developed a flip top for toothbrush. We're not going to get into that, but the flosser is just amazing. And they also have refillable mouthwash, so you're not using a bunch of plastic bottles over and over again. They also have gum, actually, and a great sort of like Pez-like dispenser. All the products are amazing. They are an amazing design company that focus on dental hygiene. And on top of that, Quip delivers brush heads, fresh floss, and other refills every month from just $5 on. No extra shipping cost associated. Every 3 months, you should change your toothbrush head. You'll never have to think about it again. If you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you're going to get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/majority, spelled GETQUIP.com, getquip.com/majority, Quip, the good habits company. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will play the interview I did with David Dayan just about an hour ago. And it is on his piece, which we will put a link to at majority.fm and in the YouTube and podcast description on how legislation gets made in 2020. Very, very important to know from the perspective if you're somebody who is an activist, if you're someone who has curiosity about this, like knowledge of this system, and also, well, I mean, we'll talk about this in the interview. Check it out. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Joining me now, the executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan. David, thank you so much for showing up today.
Thanks for having me once again.
Did not want to imply that you, I thought there was any doubt that you were going to show up. I just wanted to, that was just what came out of my mouth.
I am a fugitive from justice. So, it is rare that I make an appearance from my underground lair.
Yes. Well, and much appreciated. All right. So with that said, you've written a big piece in the October issue of the American Prospect magazine. Mm-hmm. Folks can check it out at, prospect.org. I am a subscriber, so I can't tell if it's, you guys don't do paywalls, do you? No, wait, do you?
No,
no,
no, we will never have a paywall at the Prospect.
All right. There you go. The piece basically goes, deep into how we got the IRA, which is the Inflation Reduction Act. And really, I mean, can we just say right up front, it really has very little to do, if anything, with reducing inflation.
Yeah, I think we can stipulate that. Although, okay. You know, I mean, there are effectively price discounts on prescription drugs eventually.
Right.
And that will, reduce cost of living, at least for seniors.
Okay, so fair enough. So in a very narrow sense, it addresses that. But I think you and I both agree. Maybe you don't. I don't know. For me personally, it's nice to see Democrats taking some type of political advantage of the moment and getting an agenda, and this, we will go through the ups and downs of this bill. But the idea of them basically addressing it's politics done right. I mean, the name of the bill at the end of the day is less relevant than what's in the bill. Yeah. And if it made Joe Manchin feel good or other people feel good that this was an Inflation Reduction Act, great. All right. So you basically go back, really 10 years.
More really. I mean, yeah. The components of this bill that made it through, because remember we had this thing called Build Back Better, which was the entire Democratic agenda, right? It was a State of the Union put into one bill. And the idea was we're going to pass this one bill that fixes everything. And in the end, it got winnowed down and winnowed down and winnowed down. And it resulted in the Inflation Reduction Act. And so my initial question setting out was that, okay, what is the unifying thread here? What is the policies that made it through? What distinction is made between them and those that were left on the cutting room floor? And the answer is that they just had sort of longer pedigrees, that they were being debated and talked about in Washington for decades and decades and decades, creating sort of a policy network among the outside groups, creating a comfort level within Washington among members of Congress, and creating forward momentum for passage. And even though these weren't necessarily the top items on the, I mean, I don't think healthcare was necessarily above some of these other items. Climate sort of surged to the top because of a lot of work that was done. But it was really about, they were around the longest.
All right. And so there's really, I mean, there's two major lessons. We're going to go through the specifics of this, but there's two major lessons that I took away based upon on that description of your piece, which is one, there is a lot of value in fighting these battles, even though you're not going to win today or tomorrow, but, yeah. Or really, you know, next week you might, is the point. Secondly, we're just screwed in terms of being able to functionally govern in a way that really addresses problems of the moment.
I mean, I say that in the piece, like, yes. This is no way to run a country. Like we had a serious climate problem 30 years ago. We needed to address it then. We didn't have to sort of, as I say in the piece, like take 30 years to put a climate bill in the congressional octagon and have it spit out at a time when, you know, global temperatures have already risen to a degree that is unsustainable. So it shows it's about a failing of Washington, but it's also about how Washington at this point ultimately works. And that's something that the public and also, you know, groups trying to affect legislation really need to know.
Yep. Yeah, it really is fascinating. And we should just say, you know, just to start this, and then we'll get into the specifics of this, mm-hmm. Out from the bill and from like the priorities that I think a lot of people had, you know, some addressing of childcare, mm-hmm. you know, in the context of pre-K education, mm-hmm. and also childcare, you know, in the context of outside of education per se.
Yeah. Yeah.
Addressing the higher ed, you know, some type of free college option and how to deal with that. Housing, which is an acute issue in this country, both from like, take it from like the homelessness problem, the unhoused, through to how expensive it is for people to rent. And
those are related.
And shortages. Paid leave. Sick leave, parental leave, however you want to slice that, in-home elder care, expenses. Folks my age and your age certainly understand and appreciate like just how messed up this is, because of what's going on with our parents. I don't know about yours, but certainly with mine. And
what are you talking about my parents for? They're fine.
And child poverty. But just broadly speaking, you probably hear stories. All right. So, but let's go. Let's start first. There was four elements of the Inflation Reduction Act, essentially. Climate change. There was, prescription drugs and ACA improvements and corporate tax and, reforming the IRS in some fashion, or actually like bolstering it. So basically a four.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, you could put it into climate, healthcare and taxes.
Tax, right.
But you know, those two healthcare pieces are pretty distinct.
Yes.
Right. The subsidies for the ACA and the prescription drug reform. So in that sense, there are four.
All right. So let's go through the first, mm-hmm. climate. This story starts with Ron Wyden, visiting and, I can't remember the second lawmaker now, visiting.
Murkowski.
Yeah. Murkowski, from, Alaska, visiting Joe Manchin when he's like in year two of his, Senate stint. Take it from there.
Yeah. This is in 2012 and Wyden, it's before the 2012 election. Wyden and Murkowski are, vying essentially to become the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. If the Democrats win and held the Senate, then Wyden would become the chair. The Republicans overtake the Democrats and take the Senate. Murkowski is going to become the chair of that committee. And Manchin invites both of them to tour energy facilities in West Virginia. And all of them, you know, there's, I guess, a solar facility, all the way down to a coal plant. And when I talked to Wyden about this, he's like, you know, I asked him, are you sure you really want me to tour a coal plant? He did. And these facilities were scattered all over West Virginia. So they're in like a bus or something, or some kind of van. And it's the three senators. And Wyden just sort of gets to talking with Manchin about, you know, the future of energy and what he'd like to see. And he finds an opening to pitch this idea of which would eventually become a bill called the Clean Energy for America Act. And what it basically says is that, you know, in the past, there were literally over 40 different tax credits for various types of energy. A tax credit for solar, a tax credit for wind, a tax credit for production, a tax credit for installation. And they, none of them worked together, and they all were short term and had to be, you know, there was always a mad scramble at the end of the year to renew some of these tax credits. And it was just like a, not an intelligent system. It wasn't really designed very well. It was just sort of a grab bag of different tax credits. And Wyden said to Manchin, you know, what if we just change this completely and made it emissions led so that whatever reduces emissions can get the tax credit? And Manchin kind of perked up and he said, does that mean carbon capture? Does that mean hydrogen? And Wyden said, yeah, if it reduces emissions, we're going to incentivize it. And that's really the origin of what would become the Inflation Reduction Act's climate piece, which the bulk of it are these tax credits that redesign that tax credit system and enhance it and give these tax credits based on emissions reduction for fuels, for energy efficiency, and for power.
All right. And I just want to just make sure that people understand this distinction here. The difference is, instead of targeting tax credits on specific mechanisms to right. reduce emissions, it basically says you get tax credits as long as there's emissions reductions. And is there a threshold? In other words, it's like, you know, if I'm putting half of a pound, you know, if I'm putting just a milliliter less emissions, do I get a tax credit, or is there a threshold? There has to be X amount, or is it prorated relative to the reduction in emissions?
I think it's any reduction. I don't know the parameters of that necessarily. What I do know is that the tax credits continue until overall emissions go to a level that is stipulated specifically that is consistent with the climate goals. So instead of these tax credits expiring in a year or expiring in 2 years, they are guaranteed to go for a decade and or more as long as there is a continued need to cut emissions to improve or mitigate the effects of climate change.
And we should say that that provision is analogous to like the idea of economic stabilizers. Like certain things will kick in if inflation, if unemployment reaches certain levels. I mean, where that way it's sort of like idiot proof and political proof in some level, right? It's like,
well, it just doesn't go away. I mean, right. You know,
if and it doesn't
you
have
are,
to be renewed.
Yeah, if you're an energy investor and you want to invest in a wind farm, but you're not sure if the tax credit is going to be available by the time the wind farm is done, because you know, it technically expires within a year, you're not going to invest in that wind farm.
Right.
And so this clarifies that, yes, you know, this investment is available. You're going to get the benefits of it, and you can go ahead.
Let's talk about the Waxman-Markey bill. Mm-hmm. This was introduced back in during the Obama administration.
Yeah, 2009, 2010. Yeah.
And Wyden, in trying to fashion what ultimately became some of the climate provisions in the IRA, saw the failure of Waxman-Markey and learned from that. What was the failure? And in some respects, it's completely shifted. It's both shifted, I think, like the approach to dealing with climate in terms of like legislation, But also, I think there's a bigger lesson there too, it seems to me, in terms of, like, you know, we saw it in the context of the IRA writ large, which is like, you're better off, and also, I guess, because of reconciliation, you're better off spending towards a goal rather than trying to pull back in some areas.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And you actually have to go back to the Clinton effort to pass what was called the BTU tax, which was a tax on the heat content of energy. And that failed pretty miserably in 1993. Cap and trade was sort of the function that was used in Waxman-Markey, but it had the same essential goal of putting a cap on you know, climate emission producing energy. And the way it did it was through a market mechanism where there was this cap, but if you were under a certain emissions level, you could trade credits to other higher polluting entities. And as long as you stayed under that emissions cap, everything was good. So this was essentially a way to produce a tax on carbon without actually producing it. But I think the lesson that was taken was that these things weren't working because you just couldn't sell them. Putting a price on energy was kind of the worst possible way to rally a group of lawmakers around an idea. It fed into the Republican notion that you're taxing energy, you're going to increase home electric bills, you're going to increase gas prices, and that wasn't something that was easily overcome. And so, you know, there were even states, like liberal states like Washington State, which tried to pass a carbon tax, a price on carbon, and it failed, you know, even in a very liberal state at the ballot box. And so it just didn't add up as an idea that had political traction. Maybe, you know, in a lab, an economist said this is the most efficient way to reduce carbon emissions. But in the real world, it was not something that could be done.
And so we evolved from Waxman-Markey, and you recount sort of the way that this worked into what slowly became the Green New Deal, which was much more oriented towards spending, focusing on the spending as a way of both providing benefits to people, which is easier for politicians to sort of like, I guess, accept and buy, because I'm going to be able to tell my constituents, look it, here's funding for new jobs, or here's funding for this. Exactly. And you know, it's interesting because I think another area where I see the efficacy of this type of thing in terms of its policy impact, and in this instance, it was to the detriment, I believe, but the Gates Foundation poured, I think, close to like, was it like $1 billion in an experiment in the on the West Coast of like some schools back in the aughts, and then probably deployed a couple other billions of dollars to sort of like encourage education to move towards the whole sort of like value added teaching and high stakes testing. And it was very effective in moving education policy for the worst, we should say. I want to make this absolutely clear. Like the Rand Corporation was hired by the Gates Foundation to assess their own project. And, in 2017, I think it was, came back and said, yeah, total failure. We should have never done this. Listen to educators. But the two lessons from that are, one, you should not have a billionaire who on a whim thinks that he knows education, even though he doesn't. And you don't have a bunch of stakeholders in there who can set him straight. But two, if you deploy a big chunk of money in a certain area, you can certainly influence a whole sector. Education's massive. Even if there's a lot of other spending going on in there, a chunk of concentrated money can really move things in a specific direction.
Sure. And I mean, you can pick a better example than Bill Gates and schools. I mean, the reason it's called the Green New Deal, it actually has links in this sense, in the investment sense, to many of the items that were in the original New Deal, things like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and other interventions that were just funding things to get projects off the ground and enable more job creation. Now, the difference is that the initial Green New Deal saw them as investments, as grants, as direct investments. This is smuggled in through the tax code, which is just, you know, it was following a well-worn path. Path dependency, I think, is a big thing to think about in the context of this story. It was following the path of the production tax credits, the investment tax credits, the things that we already had. It was just clarifying them and making them smarter, essentially. But that creates a bit of a problem. I mean, right now, the most important agency in the federal government with respect to climate is the Treasury Department, because they're the ones that are going to set the rules for all of these various tax credits, not just the tax credits on, emissions reduction that we've been talking about, but the electric vehicle tax credits as well. These point of sale rebates that are supposed to be given to people who buy electric vehicles, which have certain attributes to them, certain homegrown or friendly grown battery component and supply chain and things like that. So, what does that mean? It creates a power center within the government in Treasury, which, you know, Treasury is kind of the most friendly government to, or friendly agency to, the sort of economic style of thinking, the kind of neoliberal style of thinking. So what is that going to manifest with these tax credits? We'll have to see. But it's distorting. They're not experts on climate.
I mean, right.
You know, the Treasury officials are not experts on climate. And yet we are forcing them to be so, because there's a comfort level in Congress with doing everything through the tax code.
Why? I mean, I know it's path dependency, but is it because there's already an apparatus there? And
it's
so,
something that lawmakers can understand. We've passed the investment tax credit before. I've been to my district and I've talked to, you know, people in the wind and energy industry who tell me they got benefits from that tax credit. So I can sell this to them as, we're doing it even better for you. It has a pedigree. It has a track record, and they feel like they can grasp onto that and understand it. So policy innovation is very hard to get through Congress, because members of Congress just fall back on what they know.
At one point you had a quote in your piece, as you were talking about the Green New Deal and how it mutated into, you know, how it manifests itself in the IRA, which, you know, it comes through the tax code, as you say. Mm-hmm. But you were talking about Coons and Warner, who you rightly say, often viewed skeptically by the left. Yes, yeah. I think that is the case. I think that's very diplomatic. And you interviewed somebody who said, one progressive involved with climate policy put it this way: we call it industrial policy. They think of it as industry. What does that mean?
Yeah. So I'm specifically talking about the kinds of investments that they were in favor of during this process, which did get into the bill. Things like the Green Bank, which is a lending institution that's fronted by about $27 billion in seed capital that can make, investments, can make lending to green projects, renewable energy or what have you. And then they cycle that through and continue lending as it circulates through the economy, probably get a 10-to-1 investment boost on that, and it probably can, you know, lend $250 billion in lending for green energy. The Coons Warner side of that sees that as, oh, well, that's very responsible. It means that, you know, we're creating lending institutions for this purpose, and we'll make back our seed capital, and it'll make money, and it's doing well by doing good, as the Clinton administration was so fond of saying. For the left, it's finally the federal government is playing a role in, you know, this was kind of derided as picking winners and losers,
right,
in, you know, in the past. But it's saying we prioritize these particular industries, and we are going to create the conditions for those industries to thrive in the United States in domestic production, manufacturing, with good paying jobs. And so both sides can take something from that. One side says, oh, this is a market-based mechanism for this kind of development. And the other side says, this is, you know, government-directed investment in industries that we favor. And both sides can take that and run with it.
So this is basically, I mean, it's industrial policy. It's just the tool is a little bit more friendly to neoliberals on some level.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right.
And how much where is this green bank, like, where, like, who manages it?
Well, I don't think we have that answer yet, but you know, there's also an energy loan program that's being boosted in its funding out of the Department of Energy.
Okay.
So that one we do know where it's coming from. The Green Bank, that's a good question. I mean, I don't think we've had the full implementation of that yet. So we don't know exactly whether that's going to be some sort of quasi-governmental entity, sort of outside of government, like a Fannie Mae kind of thing. We'll see.
All right. And then we go through the IRA, and essentially what you argue is that the presidential primary ended up being like almost like a rolling think tank for ideas around climate, of which a lot of these emanated.
Yeah. I think you have to go back a little bit. So the climate movement, you know, there's sort of these what I detail in the bill in the story, is there's sort of these parallel movements happening. Inside Congress, you have Wyden sort of putting together this clean energy tax program for energy investment and picking up sponsors and talking to Manchin, doing all that. On the outside groups, climate groups, were kind of adrift after Waxman-Markey. They didn't really know which way to go. There were a lot of groups that were just sort of lashing out with rage. You have the youth climate strike. You have, you know, people getting, you know, chaining themselves to the White House gate and getting arrested. You have, even at a higher level, places, people like the Sierra Club and their Beyond Coal campaign, which was litigating the shutdown coal plants. But there wasn't sort of a unifying, like, what is the strategy? What is the bill? What are we going to do? And so there were these convenings of all of these groups in 2017, 2018, 2019 to determine, like, what is our strategy? What is our plan? And what they came up with, I think, was enhanced by the presidential race when Jay Inslee, his campaign was pretty much unilaterally climate focused. And a lot of the people who came out of his campaign joined a group called Evergreen, which was one of the more influential groups on this particular bill. Jamal Rad is the executive director. He was, you know, a top official for Inslee in the campaign. There's, you know, it was, there were all of these new ideas that I think Inslee raised the bar. It was similar, actually, in 2008 to when John Edwards put out his healthcare plan. And then every other right. candidate had to put out a healthcare plan that was somewhere in the range of where Edwards had set the bar. And I think a similar dynamic happened in 2019, 2020 during the presidential primary. Inslee puts out this plan that was the gold standard, has everything that environmentalists would ever want. And so the other campaigns had to keep up. They had to set the, you know, get somewhere near that level or above that level. And so it was a virtuous circle of creating of ideas. The one thing I would say is that the climate group's strategy was really a three-pronged strategy. It was about investment, which was, you know, similar to what Wyden was talking about. It was about justice, which was some of the environmental justice measures and also measures for labor for a sort of just transition. And that's partially in the bill. There's some prevailing wage standards that are in the tax credits are sort of embedded in there. And some money for environmental justice, about $60 billion. And then the third prong was standards. And this was really informed by state level efforts to do renewable energy standards. Like we have to get all power plants to 100% renewable energy by 2040 or 85% by 2035 or, you know, whatever the numbers is. But these were happening at the state level and they wanted to bring that over to a federal standard. Initially the bill did have something like that. The problem is reconciliation creates a situation where you can't do a regulatory kind of standard like that. You have to jury rig it to make it something close to, what would be budgetary. And so they came up with this thing called the Clean Energy Performance Program, which would pay utilities that got above a certain level of renewable mix into their portfolio and would punish utilities that didn't get to that level. And this was intended to get us, I think, 80% by 2030, something like that. Tina Smith, who I talked to in this story, was the senator who put that forward. Unfortunately, Manchin was like, no, that's out. We don't want to do that. And it's not clear that it would have passed the parliamentarian either. So instead of investment justice standards, we got investment, a little bit of justice, and more investment.
All right. And I just want to reiterate that. I mean, that part of the piece was fascinating to me, where Tina Smith said something to the effect of, like, you don't want to be the sacrificial lamb or policy, but it may have helped, like, you know, give momentum to the rest of the bill.
It was a new thing, right? So, like, newness was unfamiliar, but it did draw a lot of fire from the electricity industry, from oil and gas. And, that fire was drawn away from the other stuff that was in the bill. And so it inevitably, when that got jettisoned, the rest of the bill could move on.
That I find that dynamic is fascinating. Because, aside from the idea of, like, oh, we want to impose standards. Oh, that makes sense. Oh, sorry. Because we have this bizarre, rule about the way that we're going to pass things, right? Because we have this ridiculous filibuster. We can't just do standards. You have to dress them up as, like, some type of incentive structure through the tax code so that it affects the budget. It'll be questionable whether it's there. But of course, then you offend Joe Manchin sensibilities because he wants it all to be neutral again, where you're not punishing specific technologies in delivering energy, but rather just emissions. And so there you can't impose standards, really. That idea of drawing fire, I think, you know, is really instructive, particularly, you know, from folks who are outside of the thing. Like, I've used this analogy in the past. You understand this dynamic. I used to write scripts for networks. And I would, when I started to wise up after, I don't know, the second or third script, I started to put fake scenes into, the script so that they could say, like, do you really think this fits in there? And I'd be like, you know what? I hadn't thought about it, but I think you're right. And they get their, you know, they get their sort of like, pound of flesh essentially, from me. But in this instance, this drew fire, and there's only so many resources that these lobbyists have, and they will, they're attracted to the shiny thing or to the potentially more devastating thing. And it drew fire and it basically let the rest of this stuff skirt through, because a lobbyist can't go and go, like, we want to kill everything. they have to prioritize too politically.
Right. You saw this in a smaller way at the end of the process. I don't mention this in the story when with carried interest, the carried interest loophole that was put in so Kyrsten Sinema could take it out. And that got taken out by Sinema, and she let the rest of the bill mostly pass intact. And that was clearly a sacrificial lamb. It wasn't even a good measure. The carried interest measure that Manchin and Schumer put in wouldn't really have done anything. It was really intended as bait for Kyrsten Sinema. And I don't think that was necessarily the process here. I think this was more just the dynamic that happened. But it was very interesting to hear a senator say, yeah, you don't want to be the sacrificial lamb, but at the end of the day, we got to get this thing done.
Right. And her bill is playing a role there. Okay. Yeah. The ACA stuff, we had talked, I think, in the past about the subsidy that was ending. And there were two basic principles, I think, that you outlined that Biden had in approaching this. One was to make the subsidies more generous, and the other was to deal with the cliff. And they locked in the subsidies when they realized, like, oh, these subsidies are going to end in October. That's a bad timing for that. And they were able to push it to the 2025. This notion about the cliff, we have this dynamic in all federal programs. And the solution to this would, you know, is Medicare for all for me. And I think this, you know, the way that this resolves it, I think also gets us a step closer in some weird way conceptually. But the way that they addressed it was instead of a hard cutoff at 400% of poverty, where the subsidies end in the ACA marketplaces, they said, we're going to give those subsidies up to 400%. But then after that, you cannot spend more than 8.5% of your income on health insurance. And what I find fascinating about this, in addition to it dealing with a cliff, right? Because it basically says, like, we have a second cliff, which nobody drops off. Essentially, it's like a cliff and then like a summit, I guess.
A plateau.
It also begins to make it easier to communicate in the future. You're already paying 8.5% of your income in health insurance as a minimum under the ACA. Well, a 6% tax is 2.5% or 2.25%, 2.5% less. And if we just go to a 6% tax on everybody, we've got Medicare for all or something to that
effect. The problem is not everybody is on the ACA insurance exchanges, of course. But I think you are hitting on something, which is a sort of change in policy. And actually, you see it most acutely in the process of Build Back Better with the child care subsidies. Because the child care bill was initially written to look a lot like the ACA, right? It had this subsidy cliff. It said, we will subsidize lower income individuals up to a certain point, and then if you're over that in earnings, you're on your own. And that got very negative headlines. They put this thing in the child care bill that created another cliff. Even though they were fixing the ACA cliff in the same bill, there was another cliff, at least for the first 3 years on the child care. And it was going to be at a time when they were increasing pay in the child care workforce, and the people who were using child care who were above that cliff were going to see thousands of dollars of increases for child care. And so that became, really negative. And then they raised the cliff to a level that few people would get to it. But then that bill, of course, got thrown out. Right. At the same time in that child care bill, the principle after 3 years was that nobody pays more than 7% of their income in child care. So you're seeing this shift from just subsidizing the poor to creating universal systems where a threshold level is set above which nobody would have to pay. That is a change in sort of policy design. And I think the fact that it's being changed in the ACA, even though it's a short-term fix, this is one that I think, particularly because it's cheap enough, it's one that's going to be extended and extended and extended and become etched in stone as the policy.
And I don't know. I guess from my perspective, when I see that there is, and I understand it's to a limited group of people in the country this applies to. But when I see the idea of a principle of this percentage of your income is not to be exceeded. I mean, on some level, it's a price control, but it's sort of like,
it's a price control. Sure.
And it's graded on your income. But that concept is also like very easy to transfer and communicate as a tax, right? Like, Once we get that principle that childcare should not cost more than 7%, healthcare should not cost more than 8% of your income, then it's easier to go to an argument of like, this is a simple calculation. And this is what Bernie Sanders was trying to make this argument all through the 2016 and into the 2020 election was like, it's going to be cheaper for you and society because you're paying this amount. But now we have institutionalized sort of a certain number on some level so that we know the number that we have to beat from a taxation standpoint.
I think we should also stress that this got passed kind of by accident because they set the level for the cliff to return at the end of this year, and notices would have gone out literally in the next few days, a month before the election, that said your health insurance is going up X thousand dollars a month. So it was Democrats creating their own October surprise. And so they needed to defuse that, and that's why it ended up getting into this bill.
You also have a good story in there about the process of of drug negotiations. I want to head over to the tax stuff, but you do point out that Pelosi has in the past quashed a lot of these reforms.
Well, I mean, drug price reform is something that, going back to the Clinton era was something that Democrats wanted as a core win. In 2006, there was the 6 for 06. These were the 6 bills that we were definitely going to pass in the first 100 hours. And one of them was prescription drug price reform to allow negotiation with Medicare. And that passed, and it didn't pass the Senate. And for years and years and years, you would see campaign ads from frontline and candidates saying, I'm going to reform prescription drugs. I'm going to pass prescription drug reform. And it just never happened and never happened and never happened. The seeds for what ends up in the Inflation Reduction Act come from after Pelosi and the Democrats regained the House in 2018. And progressives have been putting together a bill. The whole thing about negotiating prescription drug prices with Medicare is you have to figure out the mechanism that will force the drug companies to actually engage in the negotiation. Because if it's voluntary, they're like, well, no, I'm not going to negotiate with you. Take my drug or leave it. But if you have to impose some sort of price on them. And what progressives wanted to do was called compulsory licensing. Oh, you don't want to negotiate with us? We're going to take your patent back that we gave to you. What Pelosi came up with was this bizarre arbitration scheme where the Government Accountability Office, which has never done arbitration and has no experience, particularly in the prescription drug industry, would have been the arbitrator there would essentially be two bids that would be put in, the drug company saying, this is what I want to pay. And Medicare saying, this is what we want to pay. And then the arbitrator would figure it out. This was bizarre.
This was during the Trump administration too, incidentally, right?
And Trump had been talking about passing prescription drug reform, and they were trying to find a way that would be favorable to him. So progressives completely balked at this and said, this is stupid. And they ended up with something that they found from the Center American Progress, Topher Spiro, who was working there, which was this high excise tax. So if you don't participate in the program, we'll throw 100% tax on you. So that seems to be worthwhile to get drug companies to the table. So that structure stayed in place. Now, there were other things that were weakened because you had a lot of pro-pharma reps that ended up hacking away at the bill. I don't like the fact that it's only 10 drugs in the first year. I don't like the fact that it doesn't start till 2026. Yep. I don't like the fact that the benchmark price is from 2021 prices, which are already high. There are a lot of things not to like in this very modest drug price reform. But once you get it in place, you can build on it. We see that in the same bill with the ACA, right? They got it in place. It had this subsidy cliff. Then they fixed that so that it's affordable insurance for everybody. You can see a similar dynamic happening in future years with the drug price reform. It's in place now. Medicare is allowed to negotiate at some level on prescription drug prices. And you could see that added to in future years.
You don't have to build the machine. You just have to dial it up a little That's bit right. each time, and it becomes a little bit. All right. So let's move to the tax stuff. This again walks through like it shows you lay out the value of running for president when you're a senator. Elizabeth Warren was able to basically mainstream. She was talking about a wealth tax. She was right. talking about, big taxes that became mainstream ideas, and that has an impact on her fellow senators, I guess, and the House, and just sort of like Washington in general, where an idea gets out there and becomes, more mainstream.
And really, it affected Biden, right? I mean, it affected the entire presidential race. This talking point about Amazon not paying taxes started with Warren, but then moved over to everybody in the entire Democratic. Even Andrew Yang was using that talking point at one point, and Biden as well. He assessed it and really liked it. And what Warren came up with as sort of the solution to that was this corporate minimum tax, this book profits tax is what it's called. And it says that instead of we're going to apply a minimum tax based on the statement that you make to the IRS for large corporations above a certain threshold of earnings. We're going to tax the profits that you report to your investors, and the profits you report to your investors are going to be pretty good because you want your investors to see that you're making a lot of money. And so this flips the dynamic because, you know, the accountants and lawyers get in there with the IRS statement and try to minimize the amount of earnings. But it's the opposite dynamic when you're talking about financial statements to investors. You're maximizing the total earnings. And so that's the core idea. And it gets all this buy-in during the campaign, including with the other presidential candidates. Biden ends up putting it in his budget, even though it was a minimized form. That was a big moment. And essentially, the way that the tax measures of the Inflation Reduction Act got done is that there was a huge menu of here are a bunch of tax ideas. Here, you know, we know we have to hit X amount of dollars in the end to please Manchin and do deficit reduction. So, you know, we'll just pick off that menu to get to that dollar figure. And, Sinema comes in, Kyrsten Sinema, and says, I don't want to raise tax rates on anything, individuals, businesses. I don't want to raise tax rates. And that the menu is like shot through holes at that point.
Right.
Like there's very little left on the menu that's important. But, you know, the Warren tax does not raise individual or corporate tax rates. And so Warren goes to Sinema and Manchin.
It just creates basically, instead of like changing the ceiling,
it's a floor. It's like the alternative minimum tax, which was actually put in under Reagan for corporations and removed by Trump. So she goes to Sinema and Manchin and she says, there aren't a lot of options left, but my option's a big one sitting there on the menu. And within days of Sinema saying, you know, no more tax rate increases, she endorses the Warren plan, and so does Manchin. And so that created this huge momentum where you knew if anything was going to pass in the end, it was going to have that corporate minimum tax. Now, cinema at the end puts in a carve out for private equity companies. You know, I think when I was talking to Warren's campaign, you know, people in Warren's camp, it was more like, you know, if we were able to pass that right away when cinema endorsed it, it would have been intact. But waiting a year, because,
yep,
you know, she endorsed in October of 2021, waiting a year ended up, you know, everybody got to regroup and the lobbyists could focus on one item. And it was, you know, private equity in that case.
That dynamic is also why I thought that, you know, they should have followed the American Rescue Plan with the Build Back Better within months, because the longer you let this stuff hang out there, essentially, you know, like flies, the more lobbyists you'll get who come in and say like, oh, I got to get rid of this. I mean, that takes a process, right? Like banks got to hire a lobbyist and say like, hey, do I have a problem with this bill? And they go and they do research and they find out they do. Okay, here's some more money. Make sure that problem goes away. I got to talk to this guy. I got to talk to that guy and work their way through it and make arguments and this and that. The shorter window you have, the better. All right. Lastly, and then it's just, what did they do on the IRS front? And can you tell me that they're not going to go after, they're going to go after rich people instead of, low income people? This has been some ridiculous talking point. I put up graphs, during the show in the past of particularly in 2010 when we had the biggest cuts to the IRS, at least over the, you know, in modern times, you can see they audited low income people a little bit less, but they audited high income people, rich people, way less.
And that's entirely a function of resources. So when you're auditing lower income people, you're just looking at the earned income tax credit, basically, and seeing whether or not they earned more or got more back under the EITC than they were supposed to. For higher income people, that you need a team to figure that stuff out. And the teams weren't there. The IRS had been gutted since Reagan. So this creates the funding to get that back. And not only will it be used to audit more higher income people, but it will be used to improve the services of the IRS, which we all should be in favor of. If you ever had the problem of having to deal with the IRS, you know that like nobody answers the phone, that their website is a little bit antiquated, that it's just hard to find a human being. It's hard to get an answer. I had a situation with a refund in 2021 where it took months, like the check didn't show up and they had to do an investigation. And, you know, it's like 4 or 5 months before I got this refund check. I think it's in everyone's interest. Not only will it try to shrink that tax gap, which is something like $1 trillion a year between what people in corporations actually owe and what is actually collected. So it's trying to shrink that gap. But it's also going to be beneficial for just customer service at the IRS.
All right. So lastly, and I know you got to get going, but folks should read this piece and really just an incredible service to understand the dynamics that take place with this stuff. Because as loathsome as it is, it's real. It exists. It's not going to be wished away. Certainly, I think like, you know, when we talk about like, the outside, climate activists, raging and, you know, without, policy, helpful, very helpful because it creates a certain like sort of like strength behind it. But
absolutely,
the policy ends up being, you know, it's like almost like the rage is the gunpowder and the policy is, you know, the lead, that actually is the projectile. I don't know.
Very elegant.
Thank you. But what? So how?
You are a screenwriter, aren't you?
With this understanding, I've read your piece. What do I, as an activist, as a citizen, what do I take from it? Like, what should I do? Is there anything I do differently, or is this really, you know, like,
Well, I mean, I think there are a couple things that you can say. I mean, I think it's important to know the process in order to understand how certain goals that you might have could finally be reached. It's important to know that policy familiarity is a real important thing here. It's important to know that the filibuster is really, it's not just that you can't get bills through, it's that the bills that you can get through have to be twisted and distorted in so many ways that they become unintelligible, and that it creates these omnibus bills because, oh, there's only one bill leaving this year, I'm going to put everything into it, and it makes it impossible to message politically. Eliminating the filibuster is a really good start here to create some more coherence in policymaking. But I don't think that's enough necessarily. I mean, I think that you're still going to have this dynamic around path dependence and policy familiarity. And I just think it's important to sort of understand, get your arms around that. These omnibus bills do not work well for activists, for outside groups. They're impossible to explain to people. They're hard to rally around. If you have 18 different things in a bill, you don't know which one to elevate or which one to talk about. I think that there was a lot of money spent by outside groups to try to pass Build Back Better. Like $150 million was spent, in swing states that no one knows about. Because it was, you know, these ads trying to pass policy that are inevitably just impossible to do. Like they don't work. And that money could have gone towards organizing, to creating the gunpowder, to organizing, to building bottom up momentum for some of these kinds of things. And
developing ideas that may get passed 5 years from now or three years from now.
Introducing legislation. I mean, you know, sometimes I shy away, you know, people will say, hey, can I write this? Like, you know, like my staff might say, can I write this story about a bill that was introduced? I'm like, that bill's not going to pass, is it? Like, why would we do a story about that? But, you know, I'm kind of turning around on that because the introduction of bills, their bills are like waves almost, you know, one of them almost gets to the shore and then that builds momentum for the next one to get a little closer and a little closer. And suddenly it's high tide and you can pass the bill. This process is, it takes years. It takes a long time to get buy-in to the point that you can actually pass them. Very, very few things in Washington are overnight successes.
Right.
And I think that's important to know. So you know where to focus your energies.
I had that dynamic back in the Air America days. We would cover, like, there's some state senator who's introducing some crazy bill in Idaho. Why are you doing that? Why are you talking about that? Well, now that guy is, he's just passed it in the U.S. Senate. I mean, that it's that type of, type of situation. And also, I think, too, you know, you can see, like Warren's introduction of stuff during the campaign that ended up being into this tax bill. I feel like you could do a story about, like, Sanders' labor stuff rippling through the administration, even though he lost. I mean,
and Warren and competition policy.
Yep.
You know, there are plenty of ways in which, I mean, that's a whole dynamic in and of itself. Like, Biden had no policy apparatus when he became the nominee, and there was this huge volunteer effort to sort of create a platform for him. And there was this Biden-Sanders Unity Task Force, which you might remember, that created like 110 pages of recommendations. And so, you know, unlike other post nominee campaigns where the progressive side and the establishment side would continue to be at odds, like in 2016, The Unity Task Force was really, it was a unifying moment. It was a moment where everybody was sort of going forward with one voice. And that has reflected itself in a lot of Biden, not all of them, but in a lot of Biden policies since he's been in office.
David, Dan, Really impressive piece of work. Folks can find not just that piece, but a lot more impressive pieces of work over at theprospect.org. We will put a link to it. Can't encourage people enough. Become a member, support the Prospect. It's one of those places where you can send, you know, anybody you know the piece that you've read because of that lack of a paywall. And so very good thing to support. David Dayan, always a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us, Francesca Fiorentini, who is not quite, are you on maternity leave yet? I mean, you're not quite a mom yet, are you?
Well, here's the thing about maternity leave. You have to have like an actual job to get it, any amount. So when you're underemployed, you just stop working. So yeah, I'm almost doing that. But yeah, no, I'm just waiting around for my 9-month abortion. Very excited.
Due date abortion.
Yay.
So oh my gosh, Francesca, you are a trailblazer. Thank you for doing what the left really wants you to do here.
Well, I just want to see what it looks like. You know, when it comes out and then I'm like, send it away, you know, like that, I think. Mm-hmm. Kill it. Like, that will be what I'm going to do.
This two rings of your bell for keeping it. One ring for now it's time to die.
This is how we ultimately trend on Twitter. This is what does it when we're celebrating your 9-month
and abortion.
Yeah. 40-week abortion, right? That's yes. When you're 40-week abortion. we've got some clips about abortion. Maybe we should start with those, since we're in the mood. What's happening at the Bituation Room? Are you not going to take time off of it?
Everyone should check it out. I'll be releasing our bonus content. So, old stuff, but you know, still good. And then for patrons, just like, I'll force myself in the wee hours of the night to write jokes for them.
And what about no footage of the birth?
Oh, yeah, that's for the OnlyFans are going to have exclusive access.
Yeah, that was smart of you to set that up where you could both like become a member, both OnlyFans and through Patreon. That was
you
smart.
You know, that I was thinking you guys were watching hurricane footage. Not funny, terrible, scary, but like, man, what an ad for GoPros. Like, that was insane. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to fixate that, like, just right to the top of the baby's head, can see, like, it'll be like, look who's talking. Emma, do you remember that terrible film?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Why'd you ask her, not me?
Oh, Sam, because you're much too young to remember.
No, I know. I'll tell you what.
You were probably
I know
in
that.
It. You were the baby.
Because my son has made me watch all of those. I've watched like Look Who's Talking Now and Boss Baby and all of it. All of
it.
Oh, over
very over different franchises. But okay, yeah.
They're just talking babies.
Gotcha. Yeah. At first I thought you were talking about Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which I have seen, and I was like, I don't know how that applies here. But anyway.
This is more of a classic than that, if you can believe it.
Did you see Hot Tin Roof? A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof? All right, forget it. All right, let's go.
Yes.
Okay, let's go. Let's watch people talk about abortion.
What should we this is horrible. These are all horrible. Maybe maybe we shouldn't do these right now.
Do you want to do the dating app one?
Yeah, let's
do the dating app one. Yeah, let's do the fun ones. We're gonna
Matt.
We'll do the disturbing ones later.
Yeah. So Matt, last minute, found an ad for a right wing dating app here, which begs the question: you know, if you're a woman,
will it take me to download it and.
Is Marjorie arguing? Taylor Greene on it yet?
That's a good
Sam,
argument,
she's
people.
On the market again.
Sam,
I'm very glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Do you do CrossFit, Sam?
What's that?
You do CrossFit?
I mean, it's not like it couldn't hurt me. I mean,
it could hurt you.
I'm not opposed. I just think it'd be nice to be carried by your partner. You know, she could definitely, she could bench press you, Sam. And
is that right? I had no idea.
Probably.
But the form for this CrossFit, like the pull-ups are just riding your body around back and forth. It's kind of the motions of a workout without being a workout. It's
she does it really poorly. Like, her form is
I don't know what
bad.
At all what you're talking about.
Her workout.
What is this?
Her
CrossFit carries people really for CrossFit?
CrossFit's is really like alarming looking type of exercise regimen where you flail around. Basically, it looks like you're attacking your cartilage to try to build muscle.
And it's also a cult, and she's in it. And it doesn't, it does not like make the gains that it's supposed to do. So it's like largely ineffective, much like Marjorie Taylor Greene in Congress, who's not on any committees and can't do shit. I am a professional. So
way to bring it back around.
Let's see this ad for this this new app as I download it.
Today, we brought in a group of conservative young women and wanted to get their honest opinions about what they're looking for in the guys they date.
Someone who tells me what to wear.
What are you looking for in a partner?
They just have to be a conservative.
Definitely someone that wants to have kids.
I like an independent man.
Personally, I like the alpha male vibe.
I want a man who really loves his family.
Definitely someone whose faith is important to them.
For me, it's someone who actually wants to meet my parents.
Why do you want to date a conservative?
For me, at least I know that we're going to start off with some shared values.
Well, the conservative men I've dated at least know how to treat me like a woman.
In my personal experience, conservative guys have better manners.
Can we pause it?
No, they don't.
Yeah, this is not my experience that the manners of conservative men, like if a man is like noticeably conservative, they're typically an asshole is my experience.
Yeah, like by congressional standards, they're usually huge dicks. Like,
You know, Matt, they treat the ladies differently. Why don't we hear from the ladies when you have dated a conservative man? Have you found them to be far more mannered?
No, I have dated some. I don't know about you. But while I was still finding myself, I was like, I can get past this. And no, I can't.
The closest I've gotten to dating a conservative man is getting into a bar fight with one. And because I was drunk, I said, I will F you instead of I will F you up. And they were just a bunch of like Jersey Bridge and Tunnelers. And I was on the Lower East Side. That's literally the closest. I was just like, you can tell them because they're all wearing the same shirt. You know, those like Long Islanders and, it breaks my little heart. You know, you want to like just whisper in their ear, like free yourself. You don't have to live like this. Cause what they're effectively saying is like, I just want a man to put me in my place, force me to have a baby. And we're experiencing a moment of weird feminist backlash. That's like, hey, remember when there wasn't a choice? That was actually better. Right.
Yeah. It's also just like, would you like your sex to be as vanilla as possible and also mostly focused on the male pleasure? Yes, this dating app is for you.
Yeah, you be unsure about what your partner feels about minorities.
Is missionary enough? Are you uncurious?
Let's
would you like to be told what to do in all contexts? All right.
I just want to get to know where I'm supposed to download this thing.
Some shared values.
Well, the conservative men I've dated at least know how to treat me like a woman.
At least.
In my personal experience, conservative guys have better manners.
I like that they understand their role in the relationship as a man.
Whoa. I just prefer my men to be masculine.
What's the biggest red flag when it comes to dating?
A Democrat.
No Democrats.
A Democrat.
Can't be a Democrat.
A Democrat.
That's easy. A Democrat.
A no Democrat.
So no.
Find the right match. Download the right stuff today.
Yes!
The right stuff. I can't tell you how quickly after the show is over that I will be on that app. I've connected once with someone who was conservative who looked me up and then started yelling at me that I was a soy boy. And I was so bummed because I thought we could go out and argue.
And you're like, I'm into submission, but this is a bridge too far.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the big complaints is that like when you're not a conservative and you try and date women, a lot of times you just get like you don't know how to treat me like a woman. I like a man who's masculine, not like you. And I get a lot of that that you know you're a metrosexual. I still get that because I date on an app that actually sends you back like 10 years in time.
Ah.
So I get a lot of criticism for being metrosexual.
Wait, so how far, Emma, when you did date a conservative, like, did you make it past to a second date?
Look at this, who's blushing now.
No, this was in college. So like we weren't really dating. It was more of a like casual situation, but he treated me very badly. I think like as soon as I started, you know, having opinions, things fell apart.
That was your mistake.
No, it was a dark time. It was like an after a big breakup kind of dating situation where I was trying to make everything and anything work, and then I realized this is not for me.
Congressional baseball fan I am says I downloaded the right stuff, and none of these men are astronauts. False advertising.
Apparently it's Peter Thiel funded, which is by Ron Filipowski said that. But I like what Garbage Ape said on Twitter. Do you want to date somebody who is constantly obsessively thinking about liberals? Well, do I have the app for you?
Exactly.
No, have you seen their question? First of all, this is Kaylee McEnany's little sister's project as well. Oh. She is, if you see her, she's like I call her knockoff Anani. That is what she is. And she, there's a bunch of questions and they're all like, so how much do you hate Joe Biden on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, or like if you could, like, it's all weird fantasies about Democrats. Like that's all they're going to do is talk about like owning the libs, you know? And
when they say treat me like a woman, what does that mean? Just means control me and tell me what I need to do and also like belittle me. When a man acts like a man and you treat me like a woman, we know what that means. I'm sorry, I have to act like a woman
you're getting a little bit excited.
We need to wash some cups. I'm out of here. Bye.
I am,
that was a great roll.
I can't tell you how excited I am.
I'm back. I'm gonna bounce in response to that.
If I do download this, we will do a full expose on the whole thing. It'll be fascinating.
I think you should, and also finally, I just want to like make a pitch for effeminate dudes.
Yes, kings.
They get it. Look at Mick Jagger. He is a raging POS, but his wrists bend a lot, and his hips. You know what I'm saying? Like Mick Jagger is like, I'm sure he's dating like someone younger than his daughters at this point. So it's been proven false over and over again. Some people like an effeminate dude.
I mean, Prince. Timothy Chalamet, to make it a little more current than Mick Jagger and Prince, guys. Timothy Chalamet's whole thing, and same with Harry Styles, who I don't get the whole deal, but like they play with their gender, and women who are younger see, or at least the presentation of their gender, and women who are younger seem to like really be into that. I feel like, you know, this conservative dating app is typically, per usual, behind the times, because kids. The younger generation likes when, you know, playing with gender for the most part.
What have women reacted to just in pop culture? It's like the Beatles. It's not like the lumberjack.
Yeah.
The manliest band of them all.
Well, we'll see when I try this out on my new TV show, Undercover Liberal Bachelor.
Undercover. You know, they're actually having a hard time finding women to sign up. Isn't that strange?
What?
Well, that's shocking.
That's so odd. That is very odd. You know, there is a an app for conservative women to find a man, and that is called Church and Wait for Someone to Tell You Who You're Going to Marry.
I thought you were going to say Ashley Madison, because that's another app where, like, you know, the one where men sign up to cheat on their wives. That it's like shocked.
That's where
that
you find a conservative man.
Yeah, I guess. Yes, that's what I'm saying. And there, and much like what this app will probably be, there were very few women who signed up. Shocker. Yeah.
And half of the ones who are just trying to honey trap insurrectionists into admitting that they were there on January 6th.
I'm actually going to go on that app. Somebody's suggesting this is a great idea, actually. David from Colorado. Sam is going to find the only four libertarian women in existence and take them out on dinner debates. That's what I would put in my bio. Like, only if you're a libertarian. That would be awesome.
Last call.
You better pay for dinner.
Oh my god!
Talking about how you're going to fund
so awesome
schools.
are you on one of those marriage? No, those pregnancy bouncing balls.
Yes.
should get one of those for your sciatica, Sam.
Yeah,
I know that. Actually, it is much improved these days because of that like the little bouncy thing I have in my chair. All right, let's go. Let's go to. I mean, if you are going to go on one of those, on the right wing dating app, you're going to be looking for a real man. Mm-hmm. One who is masculine and strong, like, for instance, Ben Shapiro, who has been, you know, what's amazing about this? Like, I don't know who Lizzo is. Okay. And I don't think that should become as a surprise to anybody. My cultural references are very, very limited to anything that took place, 25 years ago and nothing since then. But as soon as I saw that both Ben Shapiro and Matt Walsh were talking about Lizzo, I don't even know what their gender is. I knew that this person had to be a black person. I mean, it would just had to be a black person.
Let me guess.
Because it's like so arcane what they're talking about, and for the both of them to be talking about this as a story. So here is let's start with Ben Shapiro, who is enraged because apparently Lizzo, who is a recording artist.
Yes.
Very good.
Was playing former President James Madison's crystal flute, which is kept in the Library of Congress. And she was playing it on one of her concerts. And apparently Shapiro did not like the way that she,
yes,
was playing it. Okay. I mean, I should have known if he's... Here we go. Oh, he's looking particularly masculine.
I mean, quarantine. He's in his home.
Is he sick?
I don't know. Looks like. Okay. He's in the studio.
That beard is sickly.
Yeah, he does not look good. But, right, let's see this.
The reason the clip is viral is the contrast between a person twerking and the idea of an extraordinarily classy instrument. A historic instrument that speaks to sort of the gentility of America's founders being brought into a context. That
all
is
right, pause. It. I'm sorry. No, this. Is the, I mean, that is not even subtle racism at all.
Okay. We have a gentry way of doing things around here, and you're not really respecting it, Lizzo.
Madison was genteel in negotiating the 3/5 compromise, but Lizzo, because she is a black woman, has to be aggressive and not becoming of the crystal flute. Man.
How do I put this? She's black, is what I'm trying to say.
First off, instruments. I feel like you could go and question a million people in America, any group of people you wanted, and ask them to describe James Madison's flute. Yeah. And not only will none of them say genteel and reminiscent, they would all, I would say 98% will think you're making some type of like, it's some type of euphemism.
Right.
Ben
wants people to play with his flute, but they won't.
Yeah, Militant Apathy says that Lizzo is literally classically trained.
Yes, she's amazing. We played some of it yesterday.
She's classically trained, so but is beautiful. She classy? I don't know.
It's a classy instrument. All right, but let's continue here.
Historization of American history. Again, Lizzo did both, and only one of those clips went viral. And so if you notice that, then you're very, very bad. If you notice that, then this means that you're some sort of racist, or it means that you don't want black people playing the flute or something. No, I just don't want people twerking with historic instruments. By the way, I'd be similarly offended as a violinist. If there is a Stradivarius, somebody had a Strad, and that Strad was lent out to a musician who then proceeded to twerk on the Strad, I would also be insulted because it turns out that great art should not be degraded. Great art, American history, they should not be degraded by juxtaposition with vulgarity. That should not be a controversial position, but we've now reached the point in American life where nearly everything is a controversial position. Mm. Literally everything. Every day on this show, there's some clip that is taken that is utterly uncontroversial and then made into a thing on Twitter. Because we now live in a world where we do not have a shared reality. This was a point that was made by an account on Twitter called Wokal Distance, and he's saying that we don't have a shared reality.
This, I'll go a little further into the clip. This is just him being like complaining people criticize him.
You know, he's upset that people are criticizing him for being upset. The classic no twerking with a classical instrument edict that everyone has been abiding twerking. By in our shared reality. We all know that everyone has in the country has always had a prohibition between twerking and classical instruments. It's just something you don't do.
You don't twerk with a historic instrument unless you're sleeping with a Republican member of the Senate.
Now, of course, twerking, exactly. Twerking with a guitar, fine. Twerking with, you know, a piano, you know, like Jerry Lee Lewis, or, you know, twerking as long as the camera frame is here, you know, below, like you'll remember Elvis Presley. Yeah. There was a reason why we only saw him from the neck up was, of course, because there were classical instruments on stage, and we had to be prevented as a society from seeing him move his hips in that fashion and have it juxtaposed with, let's say, a piano, which, of course, is a classical instrument.
George Washington's teeth were actually around his crotch. Like, that's, they were just right there.
As you know, the Elvis Presley had a stand-up bass in his, when he played. And, of course, that's why we could not see the lower part of his body, because of the, at one time, we as a country agreed, we do not want to see any gyration in the hip area juxtaposed with older string or wind instruments. Continue, please.
We can't have shared values. It's very difficult to see how you have a future as a country if you don't have some sort of shared value. The part that's kind of astonishing to me on a personal level is I don't understand why.
I wanted to announce that the Civil War, the impending Civil War, is not going to happen because we share the value that you should not twerk around classical instruments. Yes.
I mean, this is really
Ben Shapiro
stuff.
Has brought us all together, and there it is, ladies.
This is so important to peace. We should get the Quincy Institute on, like, maybe systematizing which instruments are okay to twerk with and which ones aren't. Like, I mean, like the tuba, that seems probably, you're probably safe to twerk with that. The harp, probably not. But I think we need to, like, really, like, do some research.
And we need some categorization of other acts of dancing and gyration. You can motorboat an electric piano, but you cannot motorboat a classical piano. If it's a Steinway, they are virgins. Just do not subject that to that.
Please don't do the robot. Please don't do the robot on a xylophone, people.
Well, here's the thing. It would be nice if Ben really wanted to put out a list of which instruments you're allowed to twerk with, shake your booty with, or whatever it is that he finds to be offensive. This is so, like, my God. I continue.
Lizzo would do that, right? Lizzo is enough of a musician to understand the nature of historic musical pieces of art. And so the degradation of that, like, why doesn't she personally have the respect for the instrument and respect for the history enough not to twerk with it? And by the way, the left would have the same exact reaction if somebody took the Mona Lisa off the wall at the Louvre and then went and twerked with it at some sort of rock.
I'd literally
they'd have exactly
that.
The same reaction, because degradation of the past, degradation of great art is part and parcel of something that the deconstructionist left loves. They love the idea that great art doesn't exist, that all art is equivalent, that Robert Mapplethorpe's Piss Christ is actually a form of art. Right? Everything is art in the eye of the beholder. That's what's really going on here. And if you notice it, then they're like, how dare you notice this? Well, if you hadn't made a big deal out of it, I wouldn't have noticed it. If you didn't think it was historic, if you didn't think it was important, you wouldn't have done it. It also demonstrates, by the way, just how much the sort of institutions of American government have been taken over by members of the woke left. When you have members of the Library of Congress reaching out to Lizzo to have her twerk with a flute.
So he's saying that this was that Lizzo was essentially, I guess, drafted to degrade the Madison's flute. And did he say, like, the left would be upset if the Mona Lisa was
this flute? Flute is not comparable to the Mona Lisa. This flute, it's a crystal flute made by some rich Parisian back in the day. Like, and it plays like a flute. It looks nice. But to compare it to the Mona Lisa, like, 20 of these flutes were made. Is there, right, like, making sure all of these flutes are being respected?
No, wait a second.
Like,
But wait a second. So the left would be upset if somebody twerked with the Mona Lisa?
No, but then he switches it and says, actually, they would like that because they don't respect art and anything is art. And I had to work myself up for 20 minutes for this segment. Like, you know, honestly, Lizzo should have broken that flute in half. All right. James Madison owns slaves. All right. It's the year 2022. We should not deify the founding fathers. F that. Like, she was incredibly respectful of the fact that she shook her booty just a little bit while playing it and played a note. Come on.
Can we see a clip of this? Do we have a clip of the actual twerking? Because I need to assess here if this is a full twerk around the flute. Like, because sometimes
it's a mini twerk.
It's a mini twerk.
You can twerk a certain amount with some instruments and some art, but not, you can't go full twerk with a. First off, like, is he suggesting like some cabal of like situationists were essentially, you know, getting her to degrade this art? I mean, that is the.
Yep.
The Library of Congress.
That's the left that would, draw a picture on the Mona Lisa.
Yeah.
I don't even know if the situationist would necessarily identify in that way. But this is pretty impressive. Let's see.
Bradley's pulling it up here. We're not.
Mapplethorpe did not do, incidentally, or Mapplethorpe did not do the Piss in Christ.
We won't show, like, the there's two videos that we played yesterday. One is where she goes and receives the flute from the Library of Congress, and she's in awe of how, you know, wow, this is so old and so beautiful, because she's a classically trained musician, I believe. And maybe that's what bothers Ben most about it, because I know that he's really into classical music himself.
She can play the flute better than he can play this dumb violin.
Stupid violin, yeah.
Here she is. Let's see this twerking.
Trigger warning. Avert your eyes.
Wait, was that it?
Yes.
Barely a twerk.
That was it, Sam. But just imagine if that was Kid Rock, like, twerking in front of Guernica.
Oh. I can only imagine.
Starry Night.
I can only imagine.
Oh, yeah. Starry
the idea night. That someone holds in their hand the Mona Lisa and then go like this.
Dropping it to the floor.
I think I'm going to have to lie down, ladies and gentlemen. Wow, that is amazing. Amazing. Yep. That they're... And, of course, this is a plot by the Democrats and the left to promote glass flute twerking.
I said we should go for more student debt cancellation, but they're like, no, we got to put some resources toward the Lizzo flute twerk operation. Well,
just in case you did not have enough of an analysis as to why it was so offensive that Lizzo twerked while holding an old flute.
A crystal flute. Don't forget that.
An old glass flute.
Crystal.
Just in case you didn't fully understand
crystal.
Why this was so offensive to the gods of
music,
sound, crystal flutes,
glass in general,
and the ghosts of all of our founding fathers.
Matt Walsh followed up on the Daily Wire's report about black people, if they can find one. I think is what they call the entire network. Mm-hmm. Matt Walsh is, here he is. He is also furious about Lizzo playing James Madison's flute. That is not a euphemism. Literally, it was the flute. All right, let's go.
Meanwhile, they'll tell you to their face what they're actually doing. So here are some, a couple other tweets I didn't mention.
All right, pause. I should just say, you don't even have to take him down. I should just say he's reading tweets. In favor of people who, I guess, enjoyed seeing Lizzo play the flute.
The revolutionaries.
Yep. Here we go. It's like Bastille Day.
Meanwhile, they'll tell you to their face what they're actually doing. So here are some a couple other tweets I didn't mention. This one is from Tiffany C. Lai. She's a law scholar.
Please,
she says,
troll.
Lizzo, a black female superstar collaborating with Carla Hayden, the first African-American and first woman librarian of Congress, to use a flute from James Madison, the founding father who originated the Three-Fifth Compromise and also the Library of Congress itself. What symbolism? Then she continues, James Madison was America's fourth president. He helped shape the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights. He also was a slave owner, and he created the Three-Fifths Compromise that each enslaved person would count as three-fifths of a person for state electoral vote totals, a complicated legacy. Now, she's mangling the history with James Madison and the Three-Fifths Compromise. That's not really the point. The point is that what she is saying, and she's not the only one, Ellie Mistal, who's a...
All right, pause it for 1 second. I just want you to know what happened right there. And this, I think, like, everybody who does these shows is associated with it. When he didn't read the second tweet, when he signed up for this and had it and to promote it, because by saying it's complicated and introducing a nuance, this law professor made it impossible for him to parody. And right. First off, I will also say this. There is nothing Matt Walsh or Ben Shapiro or any of these other people. I'm sure Tucker Carlson will be railing on this tonight, or if last night, if he hadn't already, have ever done to get people, your average person's interest in history more than what Lizzo did by playing that flute. No doubt in my mind. But continue.
In the history with James Madison and the Three-Fifths Compromise, that's not really the point. The point is that what she is saying, and she's not the only one, Ellie Mistal, who's Mistal, however you pronounce his name, you see him on CNN a lot. He says this: if any of James Madison's descendants is offended by Lizzo, if they want to try out the 200-year-old iron collar white folks would affix to our ancestors to escape James Madison's clutches, I'm sure somebody at the National Museum of African American History could hook you up. And a lot of takes just like this. What are they saying? I mean, they're clearly saying that the way they see it, part of the point of this flute stunt was not only demoralization, as we talked about, but also very specifically, it's an act of racial retribution. It's sort of like getting back at James Madison for his position on slavery. And we're going to do that by taking a priceless artifact that belonged to him and just making a mockery of it. But sure, I mean, if you want to be above it all and say, who cares? Whatever. It doesn't matter. You can go ahead and do that.
Thank you.
But you are ultimately giving the left exactly what it wants.
he rubs himself on that banjo behind him right now. I just want everyone to know that. He got a historic instrument right there.
I have to say that I don't totally disagree with Walsh. I do think that the part of the point is that the symbolism is that, yes, we have come at least enough distance. I don't think we've gone far enough at all. I think most people would agree with that. But where the owner of slaves, who I'm sure would, you know, retire to his drawing room and play flute as some of the slaves brought, you know, food around for people who were going to listen, and God knows what other horrors were associated with that flute. And someone put the flute in the wrong place. Have that person whipped.
Yeah.
The idea that a black woman could take that flute, not only play it in a fashion that certainly did that flute justice, perhaps even far greater than its original owner, someone who would never have been allowed to have classical training at the time that flute was owned by that man, is able to do this in a public place where they don't have to hide the fact that they have some type of talent, which surely they would have, possibly paid a price for at that time. I don't know that it's retribution for James Madison. I don't know how that works, how you get retribution for a dead guy by playing his flute. But I do think there is some symbolism as to There is an emancipatory quality to this.
Yeah, there's a TikTok I just sent you, Bradley, from a history teacher that kind of breaks that down if you guys want to see it. But I mean, go on that.
The one thing that, like, where he's wrong, though, is, like, it's not retribution against James Madison because he was a white guy. It was because he was a slave owner, right? Like, that's where the sort of identity dodge is falls short, because the idea that every white person should identify with James Madison is ludicrous. In James Madison time, the like European folks who were here, unless you were an aristocrat like a plantation owner, you very possibly brought here under a certain kind of indentured bondage too. So, like, white people are not synonymous with James Madison. But I mean, that's what the right wants to condition their folks to think.
And it doesn't seem like she even framed it. Sorry, Francesca, just really quick, as like some sort of act that was meant to, like, as we said yesterday, she didn't come on stage and say, "This is for all the slaves." Yeah. She's just,
she should have.
She could have, right?
Could have.
That's what Bradley said yesterday, but she did it because I think she's a band nerd. She's a classically trained flutist, whatever, and she wanted to play this cool flute, but they ascribe that to it, and she can't just, like, yes, there is poetry in it, and it's beautiful, as you described, Sam, that now she's able to play this kind of instrument and have classical training, but she wasn't making that the point of her performance. It just was a cool flute.
I a couple of things. One thing is, I just think it's unfair that Elie Mystal said that, you know, oh, try on an iron collar, because obviously Ben Shapiro and Matt Walsh would really be into that. So that's number one. But number two, I also feel like this is where we get distracted, where the right is like, all they want to do is play glass flutes and it's wokeism and na-na-na. And, you know, it's not the same thing. I think it is actually really beautiful what she did. But it is reminds me of some of the performative stuff that Democrats do generally, that, like, we, again, are missing the, you know, the forest for the trees or whatever. Like, we're just, you know, we get hung up on these small symbolic things that are cool. Representation, inclusion, you know, all that, like, that's amazing and dope, but also let's actually talk about reparations, you know, on the House or Senate floor, like that kind of thing. So I think that is where I start to get, like, the more I watch it, the more I see the backlash, I'm like, ugh, why do we even do this kind of stuff anyway? You know?
But I don't think, I mean, this is just a cultural thing. I mean, it was a way to actually bring history alive in some fashion. I mean, this is the oldest, sort of mechanism that historians do, is they try and, you know, bring a piece of history and have it be reinterpreted in a new context that will appeal to young people, because there's no way that, first of all, you know, anybody knew that this flute existed, 6 weeks ago, as, or I don't know, 6 days ago. And like, it's,
it gave him shine. It gave James Madison some shine. Like, oh, he played the flute. Cool.
Yeah, it's just amazing. It's just amazing. It really is. And I don't think it's like, you know, if we do this, we don't have to pass. We don't have to pass some legislation, as much as it is like, it's a cultural thing that the Library of Congress should be doing more of this. Smithsonian should be doing this. And it's just, the problem is that when you have black people do it, it is, of course, as far as these guys are concerned, a total affront to white people. They shouldn't be doing that. It would be something else. If she hadn't done that twerking, it would have been something else. They would have found something else.
Well, they just comment on how what she was wearing if she hadn't moved like that.
Shapiro's been mad at, like, what, Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion twerking just in general.
Yep.
They didn't even have a flute.
Wet ass pussy, what?
Oh,
I would not actually say the word.
You have a medical condition.
Let's talk about a couple of these clips from the House Oversight Committee hearing on abortion. We know the Republican Party has already, or at least one of its top leaders, has announced that they plan on a federal abortion ban if they get the opportunity to do so. Here is the House Oversight Committee, just to give a sense, and of the implications of the supposed exceptions that exist with abortion bans, to the extent that some of those exceptions exist. The idea of, in the event of rape, which, of course, the idea that you'd have an exception to an abortion, it can take weeks, months before you prove something like this. Into the health of the mother, very difficult to establish that. That's what this clip is about. Here is Texas resident Elizabeth Weller. She spoke yesterday in front of the House Oversight Committee. This is really disturbing.
At 19 weeks, my water unexpectedly broke. After we arrived at the ER, it was made clear to us that our daughter, Theodora, would not survive this pregnancy. We were given a choice, though. Induce labor and terminate this wanted pregnancy, or return home and wait for infection to worsen. However, when we had made the choice that we felt was best for our family, our terrible experience was exacerbated. Fearing a legal backlash from the state of Texas, our hospital refused to allow our doctor to perform the medically necessary abortion and instead discharged me, instructing us to return when my infection worsened. In the following days, we constantly checked for signs of aggravated infection while we mourned the loss of our daughter. During this time, I experienced a consistent flow of amniotic fluid draining from my body. This was a constant reminder of my baby's impending death. Although my life and ability to have any future children was put in danger, my life was not in enough immediate danger for the state of Texas to allow for our doctors to perform a medically necessary procedure.
I mean, there it is, right? And they're doing this with cancer patients who are pregnant. You need to terminate the pregnancy to give the proper cancer treatment. They're basically saying we need the cancer to become worse before we treat you. And this is not, regardless of whether there was a way in which to actually implement these so-called exceptions, these abortion bans are horrific and diminish the rights of people. But the exceptions are just a joke. They're just a joke.
Yeah.
They're just a fig leaf, and they're just as endangering as anything else.
No, it's horrific. I mean, it's going through it, actually being almost 9 months pregnant now, having a lot of friends of mine who want to have children, who are trying to have children, who are miscarrying. They're living in, thankfully, states where you can still get a D&E, get a DNC, have your, be treated like a human being. Then, like, the state of Texas, which already, in terms of healthcare, is, like, on the floor. It's, like, the worst in the entire country, in terms of like the most uninsured people live in Texas. It's horrifying. I'm so glad that I do not have to give birth in a red state, but also this sort of talk, this, it belies the whole point around family values. These are people that want to be parents. You don't give a flying fuck about these women. You don't care. You don't care if they can never carry children in their lives again because of that miscarriage that was not addressed. You don't, you absolutely, and you sure as hell don't care about taking care of parents, obviously, when they become parents, right? They're trying, oh, Marco Rubio's trying, like, you will borrow, you can borrow money and then we'll pay you back. Da, 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 da. They're trying to get exceptions around Medicaid, because remember, a lot of them have not expanded Medicaid in their states, in these red states. But I just, the last thing I'm going to say is, like, this is why we have to think about, like, reproductive health broadly, very, very broadly and inclusively. Something that Liz Winstead and other reproductive health, advocates and abortion advocates say is we need to support all pregnancy outcomes. So that is your right to have a child, raise it in dignity, or your right to terminate because you do not want to be a parent. I said it was the last thing, but I did reporting in El Salvador in 2016. We took my mind off the election. I was like, this is great. It was 2015. Go to El Salvador. There are women in prison for 30 years, longer than the sentences that their rapists receive for raping them. They're serving for murder of an unborn fetus because they miscarried. Women I spoke to miscarried, or they're alleged to have an abortion. You know who's making the decisions? Judges, who have no clue.
Well,
no
when
clue
you,
what they're doing.
When you talk, I mean, you said that how in Texas or in red states, they don't care about a woman's health and if she's unable to get this procedure, how it could affect her fertility long term, right? And same with that example. There's a part of this religious fundamentalism that thinks if you miscarry, you are probably, you deserve it, right? Totally. There's something natural that God made this decision, or you did not abide by God's wishes, you sinned, maybe you had some wine, maybe you were taking drugs, right? And, or maybe you were just unholy in general. And so that's the, it's, the, if the woman is an imperfect earthen vessel for said child, then that's on her. And you should be in prison for the crime of not being the perfect carrier for this life force.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I don't know what else to say. I think that says it all. I don't know. Should we play this other clip of Clay Higgins or no?
Sure. I mean,
this is another, this is a Republican from Louisiana talking about his personal experiences with abortion, which are, of course, third hand.
My wife had a friend who had an abortion that I didn't know for years what they discussed. That was a private matter between my wife and her friend, but
not anymore.
After many, many years, my wife shared with me that her friend had had an abortion long before, and she was haunted by that. She would have nightmares of little hands, tiny little hands, and I was familiar with those tiny little hands because my own daughters would wrap around my finger just barely.
When she was born.
Is this about Trump?
This is a painful, deeply personal discussion
that I've just told everybody about.
Yeah, I'm sure his wife's friend appreciates that.
He's one of in a body of psychos. He's one of the craziest members of Congress by
a lot. Yeah.
I mean, let's stipulate for the sake of this discussion that he's telling the truth. But in reality, I don't think he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
No. Pretty sure he is making yeah. that up.
I could imagine someone saying something like that if they were in a social circle that was a bunch of like right-wing legislators and their families. Maybe you would, if an abortion came up, you would couch it that way or something like that. Or you could just make it up whole cloth.
It's also literally a plot point in Juno, I'm pretty sure, which is the movie about teen pregnancy, which she decides not to get an abortion when she finds out her baby already has fingernails, which for a movie that's supposed to kind of like be a more progressive like tilt, there was a bit of a weird messaging there. But it sounds like something that comes out of a movie, right? That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, like she had dreams about the baby crawling on the ceiling and then its neck turned all the way around. Sir, that's train spotting.
Oh my God.
It's just... It make me so mad. Why do men legislate on women's bodies and people who can get pregnant's bodies? And honestly, like the difference, I still don't feel like this is real. Like I'm about to give birth and I'm like, my cat more of a baby than this thing. But the difference truly is, do you want it? Is it a wanted pregnancy or not? You know? And so that Juno fingernails thing, that's crap. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's, do you want this? And can you get access to terminate it safely?
We know an enormous percentage of women, maybe even close to the majority of women who get a pregnancy, have children already.
Our moms.
This is not that they're, you know, sort of like have no idea what the, you know, what the implications or the value of children are, or how cute they are when they wrap their fingers. They know that they cannot provide the life they want for their children, or the life they want for themselves, if they have, they carry this pregnancy to term. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. And so this idea that, like, you know, she was haunted. Maybe this person was haunted. Maybe they never had a child after that. Maybe they did. But the people will be kids will be haunted if their mother dies because they are carrying a pregnancy beyond where it's safe for them. kids are haunted by all sorts of things, and parents too, about the stresses and the
blowouts
of raising a family. And I mean, give me a break. It's
blowouts or diaper. It's when the poo goes up the back of the. That's haunting, is what I'm just saying. It goes
Tell
up the back
it.
Of the baby. I'm very much looking forward to it. I just want to say.
Where do you see what comes out first from the baby for like the first 2 or 3 weeks?
Oh,
it's
yes.
It's not poop. It's something else.
Something like called like, it's like macadamia.
I can't.
It's meconia. I know what it is. Yeah. It's black. But I did want to say, I think it's amazing that. You know, this is also a moment where the right is freaking out about big tech. Oh, big tech censoring, da da da. Meanwhile, Shapiro gets number one, you know, on Facebook views every single goddamn week. You can't put abortion in a YouTube title and have it monetized. Like, that might have changed in the last couple months, but tech and corporations are still on the wrong side of this. You can't openly say this. The algorithm will absolutely suppress it if you openly talk about abortion. So I hear the folks who are like, let's just say it. Let's talk about it. Put it in the titles. Who cares? I mean, you are effectively limiting our ability to free speech about it.
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily look at it in terms of free speech. If this, the whole show gets demonetized because we're talking about abortion, you know, so be it. Their algorithms are problematic because of the stuff that they feed and don't feed, without a doubt. They're not going to promote videos that aren't going to make them money. They're demonetizing it for themselves as well.
I don't know. I've had pre-roll ads on some of my videos, which, you know, are like, they're just pro-life videos. They're just like a little fetus being like, this is Clarissa, bleep, bloop, blop, you know? And she's like, she survived an abortion or whatever. And then it's like a dude who's like 35. He's like, oh, I'm an abortion survivor. I mean, they're running those kinds of ads. So anyway, I think it's a little more insidious.
Well, on Monday, we'll talk about the passage of some of this antitrust stuff that's happening. There was all around the tech, and there was predominantly Democrats passed it. There were like 35, I think, or 16 Democrats who voted against it, 35 who voted for it. We'll talk more about that. You brought up big tech.
Okay.
We'll talk about that. And let's talk about the student debt lawsuits and what the Biden administration did in response to there's really two different lawsuits, as far as I know, or at least multiple different plaintiffs. And it's two different lawsuits. On Thursday, 6 Republican-led states sued Biden to block his student loan forgiveness. Prior to that, there was a right-wing organization, trying to think of what the name of it was. I don't know if it wasn't quite the Federalist Society. It was a right-wing organization that had brought suit for on behalf of one of the people working there. And the guy did not want to be forced to have his student loan debt forgiven. Because he might incur a tax liability associated with it from his state. And, you know, this is just a way for them to sink the loan. I mean, it was not necessarily the most it was disingenuous. I mean,
well, it'll put him in a different tax bracket. Obviously, it's the same strategy they did with the and are doing still with the ACA.
It's pretty funny, though, what ultimately happened. The Biden administration, again, there are two suits. The Biden administration and the DOJ basically said, okay, we are both making it optional now. You can opt out of debt forgiveness. Even though we're doing it automatically for people, you are allowed to opt out if you want. And then they personally canceled his debt forgiveness. And so that because he was suing for it, the DOJ just went in and they said, okay, we will not forgive your debt. And the reason why they had to find this guy to do it was because they have a problem with standing, which, just to remind people, means if you're going to sue because of damages, you need to be the person who is suffering those damages. And if you're not, you're not party to the suit. And because he has the opportunity to either opt out, and now because he himself is not getting student loan debt forgiveness, he has no standing, and that case is not going to move forward. The diminishment of the number of people, which was announced, I guess, today or yesterday, who are eligible for student debt relief, is in many respects the same issue. The six Republican attorney generals brought the suit in part because they have some type of relationship with some private entities who administer federal student loans. The states argue that they have like relationships. Maybe they've invested in some of these. Maybe their pension funds are in with these private companies. And the Biden administration had basically said, if you have those federal, those privately held federal loans, you can consolidate all of this into a federal loan, and then we'll give you the debt forgiveness. Because you don't have the ability necessarily to forgive a federal, I mean, a private loan.
Right.
Because you don't hold the note. But if you invite people to, if you to mix your privately held loan with a publicly held loan, consolidate those loans, then they can give you the debt relief that would apply to that. In Missouri, Attorney General Eric Schmidt argued that the Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority, which is like a quasi-state entity, owns and services federally guaranteed student loans, they will face economic harm from the debt relief program.
Oh, poor baby.
In Nebraska, some of the pension fund is in one of these private services. And so the Biden administration had a choice, which was to allow this suit to continue and perhaps either delay, certainly I imagine delay, but completely undercut the ability of the administration to provide student debt relief to 45 million Americans. They basically made the decision and to cordon off those people who are in that situation where they have private loans that are serviced by private entities, and basically say you cannot consolidate them going forward. And by the administration count, like the cohort of people who exist in there is being reported as about 3 to 4 million people. Mm-hmm. So it would reduce the number of people who are getting student loan debt relief to by 3 or 4 million people. However, apparently within that cohort, like 1.5 million of them have other federally owned student loans, which they will get the debt relief on there. And 1.6 million borrowers will have, those are the direct loans. Another 1.5 have a certain type of privately held federal loan, an FFEL consolidation loan. Theirs would have been very difficult to relieve anyways. So according to the administration, there's 770,000 borrowers who are going to be directly affected, and they are going to lose their loan forgiveness because of this Republican lawsuit, or at least the Biden administration's response to it. Frankly, I would imagine the lawyers in the Biden administration have figured out this is the best way to preserve the loan relief for 41, 42 million Americans. The Department of Education has said, we're going to try and figure out a way to get around this in the meantime, but you know, the way that it's being reported that the Biden administration is shrinking this, mm-hmm. they are doing it to protect 41, 42 million people's debt relief. Maybe 44 million. I mean, I'm not exactly sure how it's counted in this instance, but make no mistake about it. This is the Republican Party actively undercutting this proposal on purpose. And the way that's being reported is ridiculous. You know, they should also report that this one guy is not yeah. getting a student loan debt relief because he was suing the government because he wanted to prevent other people from having student debt relief.
He pulled himself up by his bootstraps. He's got amazing bootstraps. So basically, cutting off 700,000 people to help 4 million other people who have a combo of public and privately held loans. So, and it's being reported as it's, I mean, I've seen it reported as it's going to be, it's halted. And that if you requested relief up until this point, that's good. But if you haven't yet, it might be stalled.
Yes. If you have one of those FFEL loans, up until the 29th of September, you could have consolidated. If you didn't consolidate since then, you won't be able to going forward. And this, again, is an attempt to prevent these plaintiffs from having standing. Because if going forward, I mean, look, you can consolidate loans. People do that all the time. If you going forward, the argument would be made by these states that you're going to do irreparable harm to us economically because they filed yesterday. So going forward, they will have no standing since they filed because you won't be able to do that anymore. And the it really is just simply a way to prevent these Republicans from tanking the entire debt relief program. And I'm reading some people are saying, like, this is exactly what Joe Biden wanted. It's just absurd. The idea that they're like, well, if we do this plan where we forgive the student debt of 42 million people, what we ultimately are going to be able to do is not give it to 770,000. And that's going to help us politically or with all our benefactors. It's absurd. It really is absurd. I suppose there could be tort lawyers who know more about civil procedure than I do, who could say that's not what I would have done to avoid tanking this whole proposal. I would have filed a blankety blank motion. I haven't seen anybody write that. I suppose it's possible, but any other explanation is just absurd.
Sam, I missed this earlier when I stepped away, but I just so is the is
it was in depth. It was comprehensive.
I just am curious. So your assessment is that this kind of sacrificial lamb of the private student loan servicers, or the private student loans, I should say, is a way to stave off like these lawsuits, because then if those aren't included, that there's nobody who has been harmed by their yes. standard, and there's no one who has standing. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. And they did this, and again, there was two different cases. One was filed by an individual who works for a right-wing think tank who was complaining that he'd be liable for income tax in his state for having this. Yeah. And they basically said, okay, A, we're going to now make it, you have an opt-out option. If you don't want your federal loan relieved, you can opt out because it's automatic for people. And two, we're going to personally make sure that yours is not relieved. Right. And so I hope that think tank is going to give him a raise to cover that lack of student debt relief. And then the second one was brought yesterday by these six attorney general, Republican attorney generals. And that's the one where they basically said, we're no longer allowing the consolidation of loans, which would have provided you with the debt forgiveness for, you know, arguably, according to the administration, about nearly 800,000 people. And they're going to work on some other way of figuring that out. But that's the plan.
Gotcha.
Damn. It's the same thing, you know, why we can't have anything nice in this country, because we're constantly beholden to people who are missing out on profit because you decided to help people. And, you know, it'll happen if we ever get a piece. I mean, look at the ACA. But if we ever get some amount of a single payer system, either on a statewide level or on a federal level, you're going to see people suing because of their lost profits. I know that's not exactly what's happening, but that is, you know, I remember when I interviewed Sanders for an MSNBC thing a while ago, I was told to ask him, and I was like, God damn, I don't want to ask him this, but like, what about people who are invested in the private health insurance industry? And I'm like, well, they can go fuck off into the night. Sorry. I had to ask, and it was such a non-issue. It's like, yeah, okay. Also, everyone has health care. What about the cost benefit of that? You know, and then I asked about like, oh, what about people who work in the industry? Well, they can help work and run a single payer program.
Of course. Yeah. Most of those people are, you know, at least the people who are working, you know, on the adjusting would be hired to administer the program. A lot of these private companies probably would be hired to administer the program. I mean, in and of themselves, they would just become servicers in many respects. And you just got to make sure they're not getting, you know, the fees that you would like on a loan situation. But that's the way it works. F the Packers. I'm sorry, Sam, but it's attorneys general, not attorney generals.
I knew someone would say that.
I'm literally shaking and crying. Please don't make this mistake again.
This is the most upsetting plural noun ever. Just, ugh, so weird.
But it is infuriating to see the way that this is being reported. Because the headline should be, Republicans successfully stop student debt loan forgiveness for nearly 800,000 people by suing the Biden administration. That's what should be going on here. I am open to the analysis of an attorney who works in this field, that there was some other remedy to stave off the potential of getting a Republican judge or something who's going to enjoin the whole program. Until I hear that person, I think that's the way this should be reported. And it's not being reported that way. It is obscuring who's got what agenda and how it's working. Should we read some IMs?
Yeah.
Francesca, I saw one in there that I didn't, that said your article on abortion was hysterical.
Oh, good. Thank you for understanding the satire.
They said funny, not hysterical. I probably shouldn't use that.
I write, you guys had Dayan on. I write the back page of the American Prospect now. So you should check that out.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I thought you read the Prospect. Wow, Sam.
I don't read the back page. I didn't. I just thought it was an ad.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Last month, I interviewed a woman who had 56 and a half abortions. She buys a cat for every single one, and she definitely exists.
And she paid for it all with food stamps.
Yes, she did.
Calvin from Northville. I assume that legislation gets passed by driving on the right lane of the road slower than the speed limit. I don't know what that means. Freddie from Framingham. Unironed collar is not the same as soft collar. Shake my head. Kid tested Politburo, another September gone, and with it, one step further into our graves. Beautiful.
Yeah.
This is all part of the Emma Majority Report long game. Find Sam an ANCAP libertarian partner who loves to argue. Sam quickly leaves the show after finding true happiness.
I hate the ANCAP title. Can we just agree they're all libertarians and they just like to say anarchist because it's cooler in their minds?
They just love... Yeah. They love like very specific branding. Find something libertarians love more than branding themselves very specifically, and I guess that answer would be lower age of consent, you might say.
Well, I got one more, too. It's also saying other libertarians are not real libertarians.
Yeah.
Yes.
Rabbit from Boston. So true. The level of risk is socially determined in the context of so-called natural disasters. Mardinity. Oh, that's pretty funny. That's me trying to say mordinity. Modernity.
Modernity.
Yeah. Modernity. Matt's comments on Ukraine yesterday were interesting, and I'm curious to hear more. Matt, were you just saying that you're okay with a peace agreement where Ukraine cedes land if that's what they want? That is, the U.S. shouldn't pressure them to keep fighting if they're willing to give up land, stop the fighting? Or that even if the Ukrainian people want to keep fighting and not give up any territory, that you'd be supportive of the West trying to coerce them to take a deal that requires giving up territory to avoid escalation? If it's the former, I agree. If it's the latter, appeasement isn't the best strategy. I mean, what's the context of this? Because I know that there was, I saw a piece, I think it was in The Nation, I can't remember who wrote it, about the idea of the U.S. should tie some of its military aid or all of its military aid to at least attempts to negotiate.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I was responding to like people calling Chomsky a tanky for saying like we should keep the door open for negotiation, not because we trust Putin, but because escalation and war would be bad. And people responding saying, well, if Putin gets any sort of territory out of this, it'll set a bad precedent. And I'll just say, like, I'm not – that sort of setting precedent game I don't really think exists. I think if America wants to set precedents, it could do a lot to account for its actions in invading countries. As opposed to just continuing to fund military engagement. And like I fully understand like Ukrainians who want to fight Russia, but I also think like if it's dependent upon our military resources, like we have to have some sort of say. And I don't see a whole lot of agitation at the highest levels for some kind of peace outcome.
Well, what's the incentive there? Because I mean, there's a financial incentive for certain military industrial complex types to keep funding this stuff, and there are people within the halls of government that feel like this is a good opportunity to weaken Vladimir Putin, and so it has to come from just the an underlying desire for peace as opposed to these other factors.
Yeah, and that's all my concern is. Like, I understand, like, Russia's the aggressor here, and I respect anybody who's fighting invaders like that. But I also think, like the concept of, you have to think about diplomacy. That's the only way wars end. And yeah. I don't think, I just think there's a lot of jingoism and a lot of shouting people down who are calling for things as unrealistic. And I don't really buy that.
I think more or less agree with you, although I do think that there seems to be no doubt that Putin saw the West's reaction to Crimea and to the Donbass region and felt like, in addition to being incorrect as to what was going to happen militarily, I think he thought this is going to weaken. It's going to weaken NATO, I think he thought. I think he thought that the West's reaction is going to be just to be fine. And frankly,
I think so
I'm not
too.
Convinced that it wouldn't have been, but for the fact that a combination of Ukraine fought back harder than Russia thought. And Russia didn't have the capacity it thought it had. And had they gotten control of Kyiv in within 3 days, had they successfully assassinated or gotten Zelensky out of the country within 3 or 4 days, I don't think there would be any massive reaction from the West, frankly. I think they would have, I think it would have been over. I mean, I think that was the calculation. But, at one point I think those people who wanted to, weaken, Putin and, those folks who were afraid of Russian aggression, said this is an opportunity. And so it's very complicated, but I think there is no world in which we should be funding a war without an expectation that there is at least legitimate attempts to negotiate. And frankly, my sense is there's not a partner for negotiations on the other side.
You know.
There's been no indications that Putin's willing to do that. But I think it is important that we continue to encourage it, at least if we're going to give money.
I agree. And I think I just think that Chomsky, being old as time and also having written about NATO expansion and it being insanely obsolete. And granted, he was doing this before it became kind of a weirdo, tanky enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know, line. I'm like, give him a pass. Like, this dude's been like talking about NATO for a very, very long time. And I think he has every right to still be mad at what's going on. But I think you're totally right that the question is, it's like, how do you not get to this point where you just, like, Putin is allowed to do anything, but also not ramp up a military body like NATO? And the answer is diplomacy, but we don't elevate those folks in our national security administrations and apparatuses.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a tough question, because
I agree with that emphasis on, like, there's not a negotiating partner. But my problem is when, you know, reports come out and saying, oh, we offered to, you know, give assurances about NATO, and people are like, wait, we should have never done that, because, like, to me, we're speaking like jingos.
That a landline, Francesca? Oh, that's you, Sam.
Yeah. Papa Woody. Oh, jeez. Papa Woody. Ethan and Hassan had a Liver King on leftovers yesterday. I don't know any of that, what that means. Given how both of them have spent countless hours rightfully bashing Joe Rogan for having anti-science guests and putting up zero resistance, it was disappointing to see them sit there and let him spew his BS tenets with no pushback. Ethan Klein, right? But who's Liver King?
Do you want me to tell you, Sam?
No. Is Francesca aware of the Italiophobia that occurred here yesterday?
No, I'm not. Please fill me in. Anti-Italianism?
We just did some accents.
Yeah, we were calling Maloney. Well, mostly.
Ruben did it first. Ruben
Giorgio Meloni.
Yes, exactly.
Ruben opened his commentary with an Italian accent. So I mean, we couldn't resist.
Well, so my dad is Italian. My mom's Chinese. My dad is from Italy, and I just have a problem when you do it is too much, because you're not always making a pizza pie. You know what I mean? You have to slow it down. Slow it down. And, you know, how are you is a nice way to do it, you know, because it's like there's no H in Italy, in Italian. So how are you? Would you like to go to my gulag? That kind of thing.
I mean, make it sound so cozy when you say it like
cozy.
That.
There is a pizza.
I want to go to the gulag.
Giorgia Meloni. Oh, my God. I'm actually terrified. I'm really scared. And I definitely have relatives who voted for her. Definitely.
Sam Green Dealer, thank you for continuously informing us about the most critical issues. Me and my mom watch your show every day, but wanted to know if you misspoke today. I'm sharing a link from the EPA website, which shows that over the last 120 years or more, the graph of number of hurricanes hasn't increased drastically. Intensity has. You mentioned frequency is also increasing. I mean, it's quite possible that the numbers haven't increased drastically, but intensity has. I would also argue that the number of you know, so-called superstorms has increased in terms of frequency as well. The number of, you know, 100 years, once in 100 year weather events increased. But yes, probably intensity is probably more dramatic than frequency when it comes to hurricanes. James Carvel Ice Cream. Should Dems open an investigation into Lizzo's desecration of American history in order to beat Republicans to the punch and show suburban swing voters they mean business?
New York Times pitch bot. Yes.
Right.
Well, James Carvel's Ice Cream is almost the same thing. Tomo Lo Fink. Happy Casual Friday, folks. More wild news from Britain. King Charles III gets his staff to iron his shoelaces, iron his bed sheets, iron his pajamas, runs his bath to a certain temperature with a plug in a certain position, among other things, according to a 2015 documentary, which featured interviews with some of Charles' former staff. I'm sure you'll agree. This is a very normal way to live. In more positive news, postal workers in Britain are on strike today. It would also be really funny if someone asked Jackson Hinkle which part of the Communist Manifesto says to sell gold investments with Ron Paul. That was really one of his recent sponsors.
Speaking of ANCAP, if that reminds me of Ron Paul being... Do you guys watch the Anarchapulco documentary or the Anarchists on HBO?
No.
Excellent. Oh, you got to watch it. Anyway, but I don't know which thread to pick up on all that, but... Good comment.
all right, let's read five more of these and we'll wrap it up. Moxie Boosted. Happy MR. Happy Friday, MR crew. Thanks for putting on a show every day of the work week that helps speed along the day at my first major job. Peace talk. What do you think about peace talks this time with regard to Russia's invasion? Don't you think us and Zelensky should try every opportunity to grab the chance for peace talks, even when they don't know the intention of Putin when he offers, like he offered yesterday? Yes. Broadly speaking, I would say yes. In general. Marky Mark Wahlberg. Hi, Emma. You host the Majority Report. I produced Entourage. I heard you were talking bad about me on Wednesday. I'm not.
Yeah,
the
I do
worst.
The Boston accent, Sam.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Sup, Emma. You host the Majority Report. I produced Entourage. I heard you were talking bad about me on Wednesday. I'm not the worst masshole. I just beat up Vietnamese people. So say hi to your mother for me.
Thank you, Marky Mark. That is true. Did get arrested for hate crimes in his youth and go to jail. People forget.
Well, okay. So you get everybody gets a mulligan.
That's well said, Marky Mark.
Just like Herschel Walker. What's one ex-wife putting a gun to her head? That's fine.
Yeah.
Southern socialist. These are definitely actresses and not actual conservatives. Conservative men are just going to call that one girl that said, treat me like a woman.
Can I be real with you? Those women totally answered like the casting notice because it was like free hair and makeup. I'm going to be real with you. Like, that's a great reason. It's like, free makeup, $200. Cool. Yeah, I don't really like it. It's fine. Done.
This twerk analysis Sam is giving is the reason I became a member.
I'm surprised you know what it is.
I mean, I had to look it up. Jimmy Files. Robert Mapplethorpe did not make the Piss Christ. It was Andres Serrano. Didn't he do? He did the whip in the butt, wasn't that it?
I'm not sure.
I don't know who Piss Christ is. Is this
Don't remember when Giuliani got all pissed off about the Piss Christ?
No, was that back in the early aughts?
Yeah,
I remember when someone redid Jesus, like like a bear.
John from Bristol. No joke about the IRS. Sallie Mae was ordered in 2012 to cancel private loans made by lying to the borrower without interest. I was one of them. I got a tax bill from the IRS in Virginia for that unreported income because DeVos made sure that the cancellation was reported on taxes and would be owed. A Trumper runs the IRS. The Congress in the American Rescue Plan voted that any debt relief that happens between now and 2025 is tax-free. They did that in anticipation. So Congress was made it statutorily impossible for the IRS to go after people for any type of debt relief dealing with loans. And again, this goes to 2025.
Yeah.
So, part two, Joe Biden, part two. That's all I'm saying. All right, three more. Banana Republican, Lula Livre. Only Franz, please. Hi, crew. I know some people from my family's country that still subscribe to Always and thought it was too soft for being polite and even talking about bringing condoms or what is a no-go in bed. So that's another kind of conservative dating. Also, all reactionaries need to shut up forever by not caring about how the founding fathers disregarded slaves in a way, especially when these dudes gave slaves rape babies and even wore parts of them. Lizzo is badass for owning them all in one fell swoop, looking good all the while.
Mm-hmm.
And the final IM, is it, did I say, are we at the final IM?
Yes.
Oh. All right. Jeez.
Sorry.
Let's see here. Who should we go with? Jibbles. Visiting D.C. and walking around the monuments, listening to Majority Report, 1010 experience, do recommend. Didn't know this was part of my bucket list until now. That's very kind. Francesca, where can people see more about more of you?
I'm getting kicked. See more of me. See me from the waist down like Elvis. No, at Franny Fio on all the platforms, YouTube/Franny Fio, Twitch. I'm streaming my last show before a little maternity leave this Tuesday, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. I'm so glad, Emma, you moved your show.
Mm.
But
to Monday.
To Mondays, yes. Because now that means I can steal you for mine.
Ha.
But yeah, thanks for having me. Bituation Room, everybody check it out.
And don't forget ESVN on Monday. Check out Left Reckoning. Folks, don't forget your support makes this show possible. You can become a member today. Join the majorityreport.com, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Bradley, Matt, Emma, Francesca, great job today. Folks, and frankly, the whole week. See you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. But the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive. Takes you.